thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. In addition to our guest interview, we'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom, my friends. This is the last Too Jewish show of the Jewish calendar year, 5784. And frankly, good riddance to a very rough year indeed for Israel and Jews everywhere. Now, I would normally not say such a thing. Every year is a combination of good and bad for nearly everybody, and Judaism teaches us to understand that both come from God. In fact, there's a famous prayer based on a quotation from the prophet Isaiah that's become part of the prayer service, the Jewish liturgy, every morning. Yotzer Tov Uvorea Takol. Blessed are you, God, ruler of the universe, who makes good and creates everything. Actually, in the prophet Isaiah's original quotation, it reads, God who makes good and creates evil. Yotzer Tov Uvorea Tara. The rabbis who constructed our Siddur, our prayer book, determined that this might be just a little too painful for people to actually pray regularly. I mean, it's not exactly natural to thank God for the bad things that happen to us. Still, in Judaism, there is only one God who created everything. There is no secondary anti-God, no devil or God of darkness or something who makes the evil that exists. Mostly, it's we human beings who either work for good or cause, or even create evil. We're enjoined to accept the good and blessing we receive, along with the misfortune and challenges we experience. And we're taught to make choices that allow goodness to grow, and bad to be as limited as it can be. As is typical of all Jewish thought, it's always our choice to make between those two alternatives. Although, of course, we don't control the end results fully. What we do control is our own actions. In any case, this 5784 year we conclude Wednesday at sundown has been incredibly difficult for Israel and for Jews everywhere. A year ago, it was easy to believe Israel was moving towards ever greater diplomatic and economic acceptance in the non-insane parts of the Arab world and would soon sign a peace treaty with Saudi Arabia. Iran continued to exist as an anti-Israel bastion of terrorism, but there were apparently no true existential threats to the Jewish state's continued flourishing. American Jews in particular could easily believe we were fully accepted in this nation, that the long history of anti-Semitism, even in the U.S., was at historic lows. Look, considering the lessons of Jewish history, we Jews should never get overly happy about the inevitability of acceptance and success anywhere, even in the Golden Medina, even in America. But it certainly appeared as though we were in a good place, both here and generally speaking in Israel. And then, at the end of the autumn Jewish holiday season, October 7th happened, and everything changed immediately. Suddenly, Israel appeared shockingly vulnerable. Its revered intelligence agencies and much-hyped military seemed incompetent to protect its own citizens. The highest levels of the Israeli government, particularly longtime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, had failed as badly as any leaders of Israel ever had. 1,200 people were dead, murdered in horrific ways. 250 were kidnapped, including babies and the very elderly. Civilian women and girls were raped brutally and then murdered horrifically, all by Palestinian terrorists so elated by their barbarities they filmed themselves as they committed these acts and posted them online, some in real time. And of course, the international response and the response here in America, particularly on college campuses, was devastatingly immoral. Some denied that what was so well documented had actually happened. While Israeli families were still being massacred by Palestinian terrorists, while concertgoers at a peace festival were being raped, murdered, and stolen from their lives into brutal captivity in Gaza by Palestinians, while the elderly were being burned alive, babies slaughtered, far too many young people and their professors here in America and Canada and around the world cheered the murderers and rapists and kidnappers as some sort of sick heroes. Long before Israel responded to the outrages and perversions of the Palestinians with a guided military campaign, many, many voices rose condemning Israel's very existence. Jews were threatened and even physically attacked right here in America. Israeli and Jewish academics were assaulted and boycotted. Everything we believed about our acceptance was put into question. Friends, particularly on the left of the political spectrum, abandoned us in droves. Longtime collaborators refused to show any solidarity with the attacked. Suddenly, being Jewish meant you were some kind of colonial oppressor. In our own land, where our nation thrived for 75 years, where our ancestors have lived for thousands of years, idiots chanted, "From the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free," seeking a second Jewish genocide just 80 years after the Holocaust. And, of course, the Gaza war has dragged on now for a full year. Hamas is essentially destroyed, but over 300 Israeli soldiers have died in Gaza, not counting the ones who were murdered on October 7th and the Israeli civilians killed in rocket attacks. War with Hezbollah looms in Lebanon. Distant Yemen has fired missiles that have hit Israel. The number of Israeli wounded and those impacted by post-traumatic stress disorder is far greater than we have acknowledged. Definitely thousands of people, likely in the tens of thousands. While some sanity has returned here in America, a few college presidents have resigned for failing to address genocidal anti-Semitism on their campuses. Anti-Semitism watchdogs have emerged, finally. Encampments that blocked Jewish students from accessing classes were disassembled, some forcefully. Still, things have certainly not returned to pre-October 7th norms. Most of us think they never really will. So, yes, the Sephardic Piyut, the liturgical poem for the High Holy Days, rings true this year in particular. It reads, "Let the old year and its curses end. Let a new year and its blessings begin." Rosh Hashanah 5785 begins this Wednesday night. Our own services at Beit Simcha start at 6:30 p.m. And, of course, Thursday morning, and our Beit Simcha services start at 9:30 a.m. It's the time to cast off the challenges and troubles of this old year. Bring in the Jewish New Year of 5785 with song, the shofar, prayer, repentance, and we devoutly hope and pray sweetness and joy. May it be a much better year for Jews everywhere. We need some upbeat rhythms in this climate, and so to play us in on this last two Jewish show of 5784, here's 613's new Rosh Hashanah anthem for the end of 5784 now. It's borrowed from the classic rock group Chicago. It's called, well, 5784.
Thinking that I can go fast.
A final farewell to 5784 from 613. You can be part of a wonderful community this 5785 High Holy Days. Just arrange to attend Congregation Beit Simcha's beautiful Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. It's just a few days away until Rosh Hashanah this Wednesday night and Thursday. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, 520-276-5675. Join Beit Simcha and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, for the High Holy Days this year. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Jeremy Dauber, a top academic, head of Jewish studies at Columbia, and an expert on Yiddish literature and Shalom Aleichem and much else. But he also has a flair for writing about really fun academic subjects that don't necessarily seem so academic. His new book is about horror films. It's called American Scary, and it's a great read. Find out all about it when we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Jeremy Dauber is the Atran Professor of Yiddish Language, Literature, and Culture at Columbia University, a specialist in Yiddish and Jewish literature, author of the new book American Scary about horror films, and he's written wonderful books on Shalom Aleichem, on Jewish comedy, on American comics. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thanks so much. It's a real great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So how do you get from Shalom Aleichem to horror?
It's a great question. I love being asked it in that way. I mean, one of the things that made Shalom Aleichem such a magnificent figure, and one of the reasons I wrote a biography of him, was the way in which he took so many of the traumas and anxieties and fears of Jewish life in Eastern Europe and to a lesser extent in America, and he tried to create a kind of catharsis for people who were readers by turning it into a kind of comedy. And in some ways, that process, whether it's through comedy or through other things, is something that really has always interested me. And so one of the things that made me turn to American Scary, the book that's coming out right now, was saying, well, there are all these fears that Americans have had over the centuries, and what was the way that they experienced them, and what was the way that people dealt with them by turning them into various forms of fiction, whether it's movies or novels or what have you. And so it really is a very similar track between the two, although not all of the movies and things that I talk about in the new book are funny, very much the opposite sometimes, but they're cathartic.
Why do we like scary movies? Why do we like to be terrified in the cinema?
So I think that you're exactly right in focusing on that last clause, right? Scary movies or in the cinema. And I think, you know, this is an old answer, but I think it's the right one, which is that, you know, we have a certain degree of control, mental and otherwise, over the things that we see in the movies or read in books or, you know, on the stage or something like that. We say, well, we may not be able to do anything about kind of, you know, these big fears of nuclear obliteration or some kind of criminal activity or something like that, right? But in a, we can say this is fiction. I could stop this at any time I want. I can close the book. I can come to the end of it, and I know that I'm going to walk away, and I'm going to be fine when the lights go up. So you can take your fears out for a walk and kind of indulge them in a safe way. And there's a real power in being able to conquer them in this kind of, you know, smaller space that helps equip you for the larger one.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that, you know, everybody, there's an old saying that, like, the golden age of science fiction is 12. You know, what hit you when you were 12?
I saw Star Wars when I was 12, and oh my goodness, yep.
So I think, you know, the answer to this depends on the day. But I think that in many ways, my favorite of movies, and the book is about not just movies, but all sorts of things, but my favorite movie from that period was probably, you know, and I know this is, doesn't seem so scary now, but was probably an episode of The Muppet Show.
An episode of The Muppet Show.
Right, which is a way of saying that, you know, you can look back on things in childhood that terrified you. Right. And you could say, oh, my God. Sure. And then you look at them and you're like, no, actually, that's not so scary. So there's something about that control and catharsis that I was talking about before. I mean, as an adult, I will say that my favorite movie is a movie that I didn't see when I was a kid, but called Night of the Hunter. And I think that it might not be the scariest movie I've ever seen. It's from the mid-50s, but it is the most American horror movie that I've ever seen. It really says a lot about America. And if people are interested in why, you know, I talk about it a lot in the book.
Well, we might come back to that, but we will certainly come back with Jeremy Dauber in just a moment here on Too Jewish. His new book is called American Scary. I wouldn't say it's terrifying, but it's excellent. We'll be back in a moment on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this fall, beginning with Rosh Hashanah this Wednesday night and Thursday, continuing through Yom Kippur the following Friday and Saturday, and Sukkot, and oh my goodness. Established about 6 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, life cycle celebrations, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going, still available for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tykes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us for the High Holy Days coming up this week, Wednesday night and Thursday for Rosh Hashanah, and the following week, Friday night and all day Saturday for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, holiest day of the year. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up. Or join us every Friday night in person or on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services every week are at 6:30 p.m. with full music. Saturday, Shabbat morning Torah studies at 9 a.m. and services at 10 a.m. all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson. All of our services are available in person and virtually. Our Adult Education Academy classes are extensive. You can sign up for everything from introductory Judaism to Hebrew to Jewish history to mysticism. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Go to Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to sign up for religious school, Torah Tikes, High Holy Days, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person or on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, Beitsimcha Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the new year of 5785 in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you've got a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are a big help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And an early Lishana Tova.
And to you.
We've been talking about the Jewish community of Egypt. We dug into the Cairo Geniza. I use that verb accurately. But we didn't really get very far with Alexandria. And that's kind of a distinct Jewish community, a much older one, actually, than the Cairo Jewish community. I realize both of these are kind of historical entities. There are not a whole lot of Jews in either place anymore. But so Alexandria is a fascinating place.
Alexandria was always a much more cosmopolitan and diverse place, founded by the Greeks. There were always a lot of Christians there. There were always a lot of Jews. There was the famous library, the greatest library in the world, until it was burned down by the Romans.
In Caesar's time, right?
Part of the Greco-Roman rivalry that never really abated. Alexandria also had a very important Jewish community and also had a multitude of synagogues and cultures, and it was part of why Egypt could claim leadership of the Arab world for, 1,500 years.
I mean, it really was the cultural capital of the Arab world.
But so, today, as I've said before, I think on this show, there are like three groups that are always vying for leadership of the Islamic world, not the Arab world necessarily, but the Persians, who speak a different language and have a different culture, the Arabs, per se, and the Turks and Turkic peoples who speak related languages but go all the way as far east as Kyrgyzstan. So none of those capitals will ever be content to sit back and let somebody else take the reins of power in the Islamic world. And yet, it's of note, at least to me, that of all these countries, really only Egypt has a pre-Islamic identity and a national history that goes way back before the birth of Islam.
Boy, and that's almost, way back doesn't quite capture it, right? Islam is early Middle Ages, really late antiquity. Egypt goes back 3,000 BC.
Islam began in the 7th century of the Common Era.
600s, right? Egypt goes back 3,000 BCE. Yeah. It's impossibly old in terms of a civilization. Jews were prominent not only commercially, but prominent politically at times, even in Egypt. And I think for most of us, the figure that comes to mind when you think about Egypt, not from Alexandria, but is Maimonides.
Right. who came, of course, from Spain.
Right.
And the big flourishing of Jewish life in Egypt was a result of Jews leaving Spain, in many cases long before the expulsion of 1492. But that was the source of a lot of Jewish creativity and intellectual vigor in Egypt.
Which is interesting because we think about it going the other way, that Jews kept going farther west and they went to Spain with the Muslim conquest there. But Spain was kind of the wild west of the Islamic world. It was pretty far out there.
Right.
Tom, very important. L'shana tova tikatevu v'techa temu. May you be written and sealed for a good, healthy year. And this coming year may be a better year for all of us.
Thank you. Also to you and yours and to the entire world. Amen.
From your mouth to God's ears, too. Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
We will talk next year.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Jewish guy buys a talking parrot, and he discovers the parrot's previous owner was a chazan, a cantor. This is no ordinary bird. This parrot is fantastic. Not only can he speak normal English, but he knows the whole High Holy Day service by heart. He sings the prayers beautifully and does it all the time. All day, every day, it's Avinu Malkeinu. The guy is very excited. He starts telling everybody at the Daily Minyan about this amazing parrot. He swears this parrot will be able to daven the whole service on Rosh Hashanah. Well, people being what they are, they scoff. One thing leads to another. Pretty soon, some serious money is being bet over whether the parrot can really daven for Yontif, can really lead the service. The parrot's owner figures he's got a sure thing. He's heard the parrot sing Hineni. He knows just how great the bird is. He takes and covers every bet. Within a few minutes, he's covering thousands of dollars in wagers. Rosh Hashanah morning rolls around. The guy brings his parrot into shul, puts him up on the bima in a little parrot-sized podium, puts on his little parrot tallis, opens his little parrot prayer book, the machzer, for him, and sits back. The congregation waits expectantly and waits and waits. Nothing happens, nothing. The parrot won't make a sound. His owner cajoles him, tries to bribe him with pieces of apples and honey, begs him, but nothing. Finally, turning bright red in humiliation, the man admits defeat, roughly shoves the parrot back in his cage and leaves the synagogue. As soon as he gets outside, the man starts threatening the parrot. I have never been so humiliated in my life. You cost me thousands of dollars, you miserable clot of feathers. I'll have you stuffed. I'm going to have you fricasseed. You'll wish you never double-crossed me. The parrot suddenly comes to life with a squawk. Shah! Already, the parrot says. Think of the odds we'll get on Yom Kippur. That was a classic High Holy Day parrot joke. The old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well and clean up on Yom Kippur. And now a word of Torah. This week, Thursday morning, we will read a special Rosh Hashanah portion, the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, in which God tests Abraham by having him almost, but not quite, sacrifice Isaac on a rock. As we remember the trauma of Isaac and the faith and struggle of Abraham, we know that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we stand before God, open to the judgment that comes on Yom HaDin, the day of decision. May we come to know the openness that this judgment requires and so atone honestly for our sins and errors over the past year. Poet Chaim Guri has an interpretation of this tale from a very different direction. This translation is by Tet Karmi Alav HaShalom, a teacher I studied with in Israel long ago. The poem is called Yerusha, which means heritage. It reads, "The ram came last of all, and Abraham did not know that it came to answer the boy's question, first of his strength when his own day was waning. The old man raised his head, seeing that it was no dream and that the angel stood there, the knife slipped from his hand. The boy, released from his bonds, saw his father's back. Isaac, the story goes, was not sacrificed. He lived many years, saw what was good in life until his own eyesight dimmed. But he bequeathed that hour to his offspring. They are born with a knife in their hearts. A powerful and troubling message of testing and mortality in this holiest of seasons. We stand before God now, as Abraham and Isaac both did, and we face a unique challenge. Knowing our mortal status, can we rise and affirm our essential holiness at this time of year? You know, we are doubly blessed with Torah readings this week, because not only the Rosh Hashanah reading on Thursday, but on Shabbat Shuvah, the Sabbath of repentance between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we will read the complex poetry of Ha'azinu, the next-to-last weekly portion in the whole Torah. Ha'azinu is Moses' final words to the people of Israel before his death. It's an elaborate instruction, a charge, a prediction of the future for the Israelites. It is both a final look inside the thoughts of the greatest leader our people has ever had, and a fascinating snapshot of what was predicted for the future of the 12 tribes once they arrived in the land of Israel. The Ha'azinu poem includes descriptions of God's word dropping like gentle rain on tender grass, and the Lord's justice and faith complete and flawless. It describes God's love for Israel, bringing forth honey from the rock to nourish and favor our people. In language rich and dense, Moses promises again that God brings rewards to those who preserve justice, but punishes those who fail to keep faith with God. In one memorable phrase, Moses says, Ki shem Adonai akra havo goldel Eloheinu, I will proclaim the name of the Lord and ascribe greatness to our God. Accordingly, our role is to praise God and to create justice in this world. Both important, but one, justice is central to our moral life. We must strive not only to be good, but also to create goodness, to spread holiness. In this season of repentance and return, we each must seek to create justice in our world, and so make goodness a natural consequence of our own lives. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, Jeremy Dauber, author of American Scary, the director of Judaic Studies at Columbia, and an outstanding scholar of Hebrew and Yiddish literature, and the writer of this wonderful new book on American horror films, as he has before written terrific books about comic books and Jewish comedy, will tell us what is his very favorite scary movie. Find out when we come back in a moment, right here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While Israel's Mossad and other intelligence agencies certainly must count last October 7th as a terrible failure, as should the Israeli political and military leadership, the initial success of Israeli intelligence at wiping out much of Hezbollah's leadership almost instantly last week will go down as a tremendous intelligence success, almost without precedent in history. It was not just exploding pagers, that knocked out a lot of the Lebanese terrorist group's command and control, but directed Israeli airstrikes that seemed to successfully target everyone but Hassan Nasrallah, head of Hezbollah, in just a few air and missile attacks. It's not clear where all of this will lead, or if a broader war in Lebanon must be expected. I certainly hope Hezbollah has learned a very painful instant lesson, and that residents of Israel's north will be able to return home soon after a year of evacuation. Well, that remains to be seen. But a terrorist group sworn to destroy Israel, and feared by many, especially in Lebanon, as the largest non-state military in the world, brutal in its actions and its genocidal ideology, has been essentially decapitated in less than a week. That's an amazing intelligence coup. In news closer to home, the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously approved a bill last week to study the possibility of bringing the Weizmann National Museum of American Jewish History, located in Philadelphia, under the umbrella of the Smithsonian. The Weizmann is the premier museum of Jewish history in the U.S. and already has some affiliation with the Smithsonian. Full membership in the Smithsonian network of museums would unlock federal funding opportunities and confer additional prestige on the Weizmann. The bill has the support of 36 different Jewish groups and was co-sponsored by a bipartisan slate of 94 representatives. Lawmakers spoke of rising anti-Semitism in the U.S. and Israel's multi-front war in speeches ahead of the bill's approval. Pervasive anti-Israel bias has infected our country, anti-Semitism is on the rise, and threatens the safety of all communities and institutions, said Representative Brian Stile, a Wisconsin Republican. Let me be clear, anti-Semitism has no place in America. Israel is in a fight for its very existence from the terrorist threat of Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. I strongly support our ally Israel and our Jewish friends in the Middle East. The bill's author, Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Florida Jewish Democrat, said the elevation of the museum's status could help in the fight against anti-Semitism. With anti-Semitism skyrocketing, acknowledging the past and acting to build a better tomorrow is more critical than ever, said Wasserman Schultz. It will take a whole-of-society effort to do this. Folding the Weizmann National Museum of American Jewish History into the Smithsonian is one step towards that goal. We must uplift Jewish stories and raise awareness of the contributions of Jewish Americans throughout our nation's history. If passed by the Senate and signed by the President, the bill will establish a commission to consider transferring the museum to the control of the Smithsonian Trust. Ultimately, the Weizmann would join a collection of the Smithsonian museums dedicated to other minority groups, including African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Latinos. Supporters of the plan are motivated in part by the view that the official U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, adjacent to the National Mall and the Smithsonian Complex, plays a critical but limited role educating Americans about Jewish history and fighting anti-Semitism. The Holocaust describes the darkest moment in the history of the Jewish people, perhaps the darkest moment of all humanity, but it does not tell people who the Jewish people are, said Phil Darovoff, chairman emeritus of the Weizmann. It does not tell the unique and joyful story of Jews in America, and that is something Americans need to understand. It must also be added that the Weizmann Museum of American Jewish History is an excellent museum, but has had financial challenges almost since it opened. This move to be part of the Smithsonian would certainly alleviate and probably even solve that situation. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Jeremy Daubers, the Atron Professor of Yiddish Language, Literature, and Culture at Columbia University. He's been the director of the Institute for Israel and Jewish Studies at Columbia. He is an inaugural member of the Shalom Hartman Institute North American Scholars Circle. If you know the Hartman Institute, you know it's a great institution. His books range from Shalom Aleichem to Jewish comedy to American comics to his new book, American Scary. So, you know, being a Yiddishist, that used to be like the ever-dying language, and then it became an important part of academia. I know this takes us a little bit away from your new book, but tell us how you ended up doing what you do.
Well, you know, that, I'm always happy to talk about Yiddish. I'm happy to talk about my experiences in it. You know, I grew up in a modern Orthodox background, and you know, was very attached to Jewish literature and to Jewish history. But the way I used to describe it was that the Jewish history and literature that I learned sort of ended, you know, it stopped in 1492, you know, with this minute, and it picked up again somewhere kind of, you know, around sort of the late 20th century, the late 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, with coming to America and the Zionist conference and all of that, right? But I had very little sense of what was going on in Eastern Europe at the time. And I finished my first year of college, and I was looking for things to do. And this was before the internet. So my parents sent me a kind of clipping service. and they advertised in this clipping service, there was an advertisement for the what was then called the National Yiddish Book Center.
Yeah.
And for summer internships there. And I didn't have anything else to do, so I kind of went. And in addition to shelving these books, I was introduced in a little sort of mini course that was taught by Aaron Lansky, who was the director of the center.
A past guest of Too Jewish, I must add.
Oh, amazing. Okay, well, so you know how wonderful a person he is.
Fantastic
guy. And he introduced me to this world that I really didn't know anything about. And it was a world of, you know, tradition and encountering modernity. And this was something that I just, you know, was experiencing in my own life. And that was the beginning. And I've been interested in those literatures ever since.
So my favorite Yiddish author is probably Yitzhak Leib Peretz, although it's hard not to love Shalom Aleichem. When you moved from your scholarly interest in Yiddish, you started writing about, you wrote about Shalom Aleichem, and then you moved into Jewish comedy more broadly. I guess when you say the word comedy and you say broadly, it brings other ideas to mind, but tell us about that transition and how Yiddish literature influenced the development of, you know, the Jewish comedic industry in the United States.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I was always interested in comedy, you know, from the very beginning of, well, of my life, but certainly my academic career. And one of the things that I was the most interested in was the way that comedy and horror in its own way are methods of communication with an audience, right? You can write a poem, and if you have this poem and it's very meaningful to you, but nobody understands it, you know, that's fine. It could be a very successful poem. But if you tell a joke and nobody laughs, it probably isn't a very good joke, right? If you make a scary story and nobody's scared, it's the same thing, right? You know, there's something about that relationship. And so, you know, there was a way in which comedy and horror is very similar to this, are both ways of understanding the cultural history of a particular community, what they find funny, what scares them. And it's also a means, like I say, of communication. And so for American Jews, particularly, Jews in general, but for American Jews in particular, there was a way in which this real dominance for a period of time in the 20th century of the instruments of American comedy, right, not just Jewish comedy, but of Jewish comedy in America, was also a way of communicating with a majority of non-Jewish Americans, of saying, look, we can talk to each other. I can make you laugh. We can be friends. We have things in common. You know, it was a real way of becoming part of America. And that was a story that I was very interested in thinking about and talking about. And I did that in class at Columbia, and then it became a major part, although not the only part, of the history of Jewish comedy that I wrote.
So I want to go back to American Scary, your new book. I remember in high school going to see the movie Carrie, the original one. Just not thinking much about it. That's what all my friends were going to. My friends were going to see. We went to see it. And then the end of that movie was so shocking that we ended up like going and getting, I don't know, coffee and going back and seeing another movie just because we had to get it out of our brains.
That's fantastic.
How many horror movies have that kind of gripper at the end?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's a great question. You know, one kind of horror movie is what is really about sort of a kind of closed or cathartic or conservative ending, right? And saying, okay, you know what? There was a monster, but the monster's been defeated and order has been restored and we can all go back into the sunlight and everything's going to be fine from now on, right?
Right.
And, you know, and
right.
That's really, and we're left with a kind of a song in our heart kind of moving out. And then there are others, like you say, and there's that ending.
Yeah, like the Brian De Palma school of horror movies, I guess.
Very much so, right? Of just saying, no, you know, you think you may have survived this, right? But it's going to stay with you. And that kind of haunting, that kind of hangover, right? That's something that I think very much speaks to a certain kind of unease that is often very resonant with us. The story, you know, the story doesn't end happily ever after in that kind of way. And you know, you have two flavors of this, of these kind of movies or texts of horror, but this is a very, very powerful and very meaningful one. And sometimes, you know, you see this with the Mark. Carrie doesn't really have any sequels, right? But a lot of times, even these movies that you think, oh, it's all done, right? You know, the it makes a lot of money. So they say, oh, well, we need to rejigger it to become a kind of sequel. So it didn't end, as it turned out.
There's now a tendency not just to make films, but to do these streaming shows that have become wildly popular. How do they differ in terms of how extensive the character development compared to like the horror films that you write about?
I think that's and you know, one of the things that I tried to do in American Scary as much as possible, and I hope that the people who are listening to this might try and check it out. You know, we don't have time to talk about everything. Is that really I wanted to talk about all different kinds of media. So like you say, it's not just movies, it's not just books, but it's also there's streaming stuff talked about. There's radio, there's television. And each of these is video games, and each of these has their own particular kind of pluses and minuses, their own appeals. And like you say, one of the things that is really appealing, about streaming a show on Netflix or something like that is that you can say, okay, here's 13 hours, let's say, to explore a particular setting, a particular set of interactions of characters, a world, what have you. And, you know, viewers can have, if they choose sometimes, an immersiveness where they do this in one long weekend. You know, you know, the Netflix will drop a bunch of episodes and you'll just sort of go through them if you have the time and the inclination. And that leads to a very different kind of encounter with that material. That can be better or that can be worse. But it definitely is different than sort of saying, I'm going to, you know, watch this movie for 2 hours. And of course, with streaming, almost definitionally, you're watching it at home.
At home, so, yeah. I was thinking of, like, you're bringing it home.
You're bringing it home. And, you know, there's a way in which one of the ways that horror movies, particularly, not novels, right, but horror movies, were almost always experienced for most of the 20th century, certainly, was in a community. Right. If you went to see King Kong or Nightmare on Elm Street or Friday the 13th, right, you saw with people who were yelling and shouting and screaming and whatever. And, you know, is that a better experience than watching it, you know, at home? I don't know. But it's a different one for sure.
I was thinking, I mean, Stranger Things or The Walking Dead, all of these. I mean, people are watching these in their bedroom before they go to sleep.
I
don't understand. Maybe you can explain that one to me.
And, you know, probably not sleeping that well. Look, I will say that, you know, all the experts say that you should probably not watch a screen right before you go to sleep. And if you're going to watch one, probably a horror movie is not the best thing to watch immediately before bedtime. But, you know, if people get enjoyment, I'm not the judge, right? You know, if this is how they do it, they want to do it, that's great. The one thing I have found myself sometimes, which is hard, is, you know, it's if you're going to a movie or to a play, right, you know, you're in it for the whole experience. I mean, maybe you're checking your phone when you should, but basically you're there, right? As opposed to, you know, if it's on TV, you know, it's on a streaming service, you might say, okay, I'm going to watch 10 minutes now, and then I'll go get a snack, and then I'll come back tomorrow, and I'll watch another 20 minutes. And I don't think anyone would say that would be the creator's optimal desire for the way that you would watch their work, right?
Sure.
So that kind of energy of, let's say, building suspense or terror, right, that could potentially get diffused watching at home in a way that it's much harder to have that effect in the movie theater or on stage. But, you know, it's the way we watch now.
Next to last question is, so what's next after American Scary? Are you going to go after detective fiction? Like, what's your next project?
That's a good question. I'm still thinking about it a little bit, but I will say that I actually, you know, have a middle grade novel that's coming out from Simon and Schuster next year about alien invasion. So taking a little page from all the stuff that I've been watching and reading, I guess. And I also am finishing up a history of Yiddish literature. And so I'm hoping that people will enjoy reading that too.
Well, we'll have to get you back to talk about those. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about American Scary?
Thank you. You know, one place would be my website, which is jeremydauber.com. But you can purchase American Scary at any place where you can buy books. So any of the major websites, as well as from the Hachette book. group's website, but anywhere you want.
Extremely entertaining, and I can't wait to see what comes next. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thank you so much. This was great.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Zibby Owens, editor of a new anthology from Artists Against Anti-Semitism on Being Jewish Now. Really great. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for service in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Most importantly, sign up. Come to the Jewish High Holy Days at Beit Simcha Wednesday night and Thursday morning for Rosh Hashanah, and a week from Friday night and Saturday night, October 11th and 12th, for Yom Kippur. Call Beit Simcha 520-276-5675. 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join us for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur this year. Play us out this morning for Rosh Hashanah this coming week, Wednesday night and Thursday. Here's Israeli singer Noah with the Israeli Philharmonic singing, well, some kids' songs about the new year, Shana Tova. My friends, may you have a Lashana Tova Umetuka, a good and a sweet new year, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week and a year. We pray profoundly of justice and peace. Shana.
Shana Tova, Tayas Amit, Rochev Birhom Shabbat.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.